Highbridge, a division of Recorded Books, presents O Death, Where is Thy Sting? A Meditation on Suffering by Joe Hoover. Read by Joe Hoover. The Glory of God. For a few weeks as a novice, I was a chaplain in a gray jail for kids. I think of it as gray because the boys wore gray sweats and the walls were cinder block and the air was dead and the quiet unnatural, and I did not want to be there. I wanted the boys to not be there, too. I prayed with them, insisted on the learning of lessons, three-point plans, step by little step, surefire methods, biblical and secular, for staying out of trouble and away from the Minneapolis JDC. Over the weeks, one of the guards, Paul, had been watching me. Finally, he told me something that stopped me cold. "Every one of these kids," he said, "will be back. Every one. These kids will be in and out of jail and back in again, some for the rest of their lives." This guard was not trying to be gloomy, he was just stating what is. He had worked at this place for 20 years, he was telling me what he knows. All these inmates, nearly all of them black children, will get out of here and live their lives and go back to the streets and then end up again back in juvie. Eventually many of them will end up in state or county or federal prison for months or years, maybe for life. There is no hope for those kids. Their souls? Sure. Lives as free men? No. End of story. 13-year-old boys headed to life in a cage. Why were they born? For this? Is anyone born for prison? Evidently some are, and others are born for who knows, endless soccer camps that parlay a half-hearted midfielder onto first-team All-Metro. Neither party asked for their state in life, it just happened. Two were grinding at the mill. One was taken away, the other left to breathe the fresh, clean air. Is there a God? A ridiculous question. We all know the answer to that. Just look around. Behold, we are so far past the beginning, and yet the earth is still a formless wasteland. Darkness covers the abyss of us. A ferocious wind sweeps over foul waters, and these children are going away forever. No matter what we do, no matter the counseling, the stern but loving discipline, the schooling, the life training, do they even receive such things? They will all be back. The guard wore a black sports shirt. He came across like a reasonable-minded school counselor, one who might lean forward in a leather chair and quietly nod his head every so often as a kid tells him about his mom's charming, violent boyfriend. His black hair was not feathered, but it may have been several years back. The boys were segmented into groups, lived in pods, tucked into cells with heavy doors and thick glass. He said it calmly. They will return. All of them. Is there a God? An even worse answer, there is a God, and every one of those kids is coming back. Who or what can we blame for this? Society? The breakdown of the family? The obliteration of father figures? A lack of jobs, the pervasiveness of drugs, crowded schools, harsh drug laws, the proliferation of guns, the profit-seeking prison industry, brutal cops, institutional racism, corrupted civil will, a deflation of things spiritual and the general culture, religious novices and their ignorance of the absurd rates of black incarceration, simply the 12-year-olds themselves? Why doesn't God, who has lovingly given us free will, take it back for a few minutes? Take it back and airlift these children into a life of excellent schools, churches that bring the gospel to the streets, cities abundant with jobs, and just make things better. It is too discouraging. The bad has been so lodged into, so caked over the world, evil becomes so stuck with old growth and tree rings and roots reaching way down, so much sadness that it will take ages to chip it away. Oh, maybe if we all just believe in Jesus Christ enough, he will blast through and save us. Like children at a Peter Pan matinee reviving Tinkerbell, if we keep clapping and clapping and clapping our hands, Christ will appear and briskly lift us out of these tragedies. Is that how it is? Is it? An act of will can upend the whole rotten thing? Heresy, you say, trying to force God onto the scene? Are we simply to wait? Wait to make sense of sadness, of evil? Then as we wait, don't we begin to feel a little stupid? I'm waiting! It's coming! Just hang on! It'll all get better! Good for you. How adorable. He's waiting, the dear. He really thinks it will all get better. God is good, some religious person says, as if she is saying, Panama is an isthmus. Who says such things so matter-of-factly? God is good. Where do you live? God is good, said by the same people who think they're going to win Powerball every time they buy a ticket. God is good? These days are an exciting time for new atheists, and I wonder, who is not a new atheist? Who does not pass into the cold? We all wish for something as clear and convincing as science, to bind up all wounds, heal every ill, patch up all rents in the existential fabric, so that nothing ever goes down again. I stood on my roof on the Lower East Side and watched the second tower fall. Its crumbling and falling felt like the most unreal and most solidly real thing I had ever seen. It was as if the falling were a kind of creation, a collapsing of concrete and mass and purpose and will, so resolute and final that it seemed in its very nature to be a new thing. It went down in a cascade of gray and black powder, and I expected some kind of mystical spirit shadow to remain there, because how could nothing be there? But there was no such consolation for a distant viewer. Instantly, it seemed, the names and faces of the missing appeared, taped to lampposts, street signs, bus stops, and subway walls. Their faces stared out as their families asked, "Have you seen this person? Where is this man, this woman? Call this number if you have seen her." It was also as if the dead were staring out and asking us, the living, "Where are you? Who are you? This is not a joke. We really are missing. Why are you still walking around while we have vanished into vapor? What gives you the right to be on the living side of this smudged, torn, and godforsaken flyer while we languish among the disappeared?" And far, far away, as all the numbers click in the right slots, "God is good. God is good. God is just." I met Philip and we prayed together in his room. We crouched down on the floor and looked at his candles and a rocket he had drawn and pictures of his dead brother Aaron, the archangel Michael, Jesus, the priest named Henry. These icons sat in his prayer corner, a cardboard box covered with a red bandana. Somehow Philip had found me worthy to help him worship here. When we prayed, Philip, who was in his 50s, talked to his brother Aaron, who himself could never talk, as if Aaron were right there. Philip said to Aaron, "You are in my heart." And he meant it, as if Aaron were literally a tiny man abiding in Philip's aorta. He also said to Aaron every time, "You gotta help me." I wondered if Philip said this because his mind was ravaged by illness, because he was hunched over when he walked and he couldn't speak very fast or eat very fast or get anywhere fast, because every single solitary morning, Philip hated waking up. If Philip was in his room and needed someone, he put his fingers in his mouth to whistle, but instead a yell came out. Or if he fell off his bed while trying to get his clothes on, he would shout, "Somebody come and help me." Sometimes he stumbled when he walked into a room, and with the precious bravado of a child sitcom actor, he would mutter, "Some days you just can't win." One day he said to me, "You are in my heart." I froze and stopped breathing. Philip lived outside Toronto with a cluster of people like him in homes with those who assisted them. It was called L'Arche Daybreak. I was there as one who had just finished the spiritual exercises of St. Ignatius of Loyola. I came cresting on a spiritual wave. Sometimes I looked around and couldn't help but feel how beautiful and spiritual it must be to live as one of these weak, vulnerable, and honest people who talk directly to the dead, who yell happily when they mean to whistle, who make loud moaning noises in church because they have no control over their bodies and voices. How holy and blessed are these wounded people. Here at L'Arche, the floodwaters were baptismal, everything anointed. Nevertheless, even if all that happened at L'Arche was holy, it was disturbing to consider the pain of being anointed like that. Maybe those back pew moans were not delightful. Maybe they were moans rising from the horror of being engulfed and drowned and helpless to do anything about it because you just don't have it in you. Being at the mercy of people like me who come and go for 6 weeks, 6 months, a year at a time. Being taken care of all the time, day in and day out, being always a burden, always suffering. Maybe that is why Philip watched Batman movies, put on Superman t-shirts, slept in Spider-Man pajamas, to clothe himself in powers alien to his body. There he was, stumbling around with that big red S on his chest, and it all felt like a cruel joke. The bitter joke that we fall for every time is that God created us to be greatly depleted so that we could become abundant in God. The Lord cast us deep into the well of mean existence so we would grasp onto the rope he throws down. We rely on God to get us through the terrible things God lets happen to us. It's all a setup. Like giving a child 5 cents when admission to the fair is twice that. The child has to come back for the extra nickel, and to get past the gate again, he has to come back again and keep coming back and back and back and has to be grateful. Oh, so grateful, this kid, to the keeper of the coin. The fix is in and has been basically forever. God made us sick so we would reach out to the physician in him. I boast of my weakness, says Paul, for when I am weak, then I am strong, for the Lord is strong in me. I boast of my obliterated face on the subway wall, my body trapped in a tiny cell. I brag that I hate getting up in the morning, that when I use the toilet, I need someone to wipe for me. God made us frail so that God could swoop in and be mighty for us, and how needy, self-involved, and completely screwed up is that? Why is it this way? It is the child's most basic question, dealing with the most bewildering thing of all, referring to life and its diamond-sharp edges harsh enough to throw us down at a moment's notice, all overseen by a God whose love, coiled up in the cells of ourselves, firing every moment of our existence, evidently drives people into the ground on a daily basis. Why? This question rears up again and again in our lives. Who gets the healthy genes and why? Why does one financial analyst have to jump from the 70th floor while another walks away in a dust-covered suit? Behold, any crumbling human sputtering and begging on the sidewalk. There but for the grace of God. Really? The shining thread of God's grace was held out to you and not to him? And he received from the Lord what, a sharp stick in the eye? Sometimes the goodness of God, the order of the universe, and the joy of any given life appears to be a tightrope made of braided grass. It could disintegrate at any moment. How come? We can look around at the created world, we who inhabit it as poorly as we do, and we can ask, who thought any of this was a good idea? It may be, we are told, that the planet is careening toward irreversible catastrophe. Who let this happen? Is it something that can even occur? Can we really blow it utterly and entirely, the energy of us collapsing the entire gift of creation? And if so, is it really our fault? Weren't we all just trying to drive to church? It matters little, I think, that these eternal questions wind through the life of a Catholic religious, a Jesuit sent from this place to that, plains reservations to humming cities, El Mozote to a small dark-lit chapel, and points between. Any soul paying the barest attention to life gasps, at least now and then, at the apparent ludicrousness of it all. No? The glory of God, says Saint Irenaeus, is the human being fully alive. And any human fully alive can get shattered by life again and again. Which leads to the question, when will God get enough glory that we can quit being so completely alive and just sit around for a few minutes? Mary Sunshine. Mary Sunshine's place was about the size of a Volkswagen bus with a high ceiling. It was populated with the dogs King Henry VIII and Sunshine, the cat Molly, a foul-mouthed parrot named Cavita Costa. We sat in the kitchen where a radio tuned to a local station powered entirely by the sun sent us Bob Dylan. "You've got a lot of nerve to say you are my friend," his bitter words coming off somehow lighter here. In the room next door slept a man named Thomas. "My gentleman," Mary said more than once. I suspect a new love. Thomas was recovering from any number of things, booze, an old bike wreck, sleeping in the pines for months. Mary checked on him every so often while she cooked and pointed out where things were in the apartment. I just kind of sat there quietly and watched. Mary's unkempt hair, the way it framed her face, reminded me of a lion. A calm, peaceful lion, somewhat detached. Mary lived in Taos, brought food to the poor, and took in wandering strangers like me. I was on a months-long pilgrimage from our St. Paul novitiate, needed a place to stay, and was directed to her house. Mary did not hover over me busily, inquiring after my tastes, my past, or my health. Her hospitality was not oppressive. A couple of times, it almost seemed like she forgot I was there. She just did what she was doing. And I don't know if there was an onion skin's difference between what she was doing and who she was. I sat at the kitchen table, breathing the quiet air, gnawing on chicken and liking, improbably, every song that played over the sun's radio. Mary told me she used to live in upstate New York, and, after a divorce and a bad car accident that left her with a permanently injured back, she decided to overhaul things entirely. She went to a workshop at a friend's church where she held her palms up and breathed deep for 30 minutes while asking God a question. Later, in a dream, she saw mountains and a river. A few days after that, she saw a photo with the same mountains and river. It was a picture of Taos. The message to her was clear. Go to that place and feed people. So she did. The mountains in the picture were the Sangre de Cristo, the blood of Christ. What a holy thing to drink from. When I woke up at Mary's place the next morning, she trundled Thomas and me to a church to stand in line for free food. We loaded bags with turnips, carrots, loaves of bread, pasta, meat, chocolate, tiny juice boxes, and a raft of other groceries for ourselves and whoever else might come along. Mary and I went to the hospital and visited a veteran named Red Eagle, afflicted with mono and maybe TB. His lungs crammed, he told us, with black guck that he'd been coughing up all day. Mary was happy about this progress and encouraged him to keep coughing. We went to the forest and took food to a small gathering of Rainbow Nation kids camped out there. They strolled the woods with authority, cooked and cleaned in a tidy kitchen of sticks and dried mud, yelled, "I love you," to each other through the twilight. A few just sat in a wrecked car and drank. One of the Rainbow kids came back with us to spend the night, along with two or three drunk older men. Later, at Mary's door appeared a young couple in tie-dye on their way to a fish concert, I can't exactly remember, who had heard of this kind lady. They eagerly came inside, flushed and hungry. None of this made Mary nervous or overwhelmed, she just made more chicken. She fed us all, and then we collapsed to her floor for the night, and the dogs squeezed in where they could. "So, where are you going to go now?" Mary asked the next day. It was mid-morning, and everyone else had already left. Clearly, I wasn't being invited to stay a third day. As I packed up my stuff, Mary and Thomas gave me tips, kind of impatiently, even though I hadn't asked, on begging, dumpster diving, and hitchhiking. Mary laid her hands on a speckled blue metal cup and gave it to me for the rest of my journey. She decided to give me a little black skillet, too, then her own gray fleece. She ended up giving me sweatpants, mittens, a scarf, a towel, a can of Sterno, a roll of toilet paper, matches, candles, a sleeping bag, a pink and teal ski jacket, a pair of women's jeans, and 4 days' worth of food. As I walked out the door, she found somewhere a medal that said, "Mary, Our Lady of the Roses." She put it in my palm and said to keep in touch. It felt meant. I don't think Mary said probably 4 words in a week that she didn't mean. It had snowed as we slept, and I walked away from her apartment past trees and bushes crystallized with ice, glinting in the morning sun. an impossible, silvery wonderland. Bright, cool, suspicious. Things aren't really this way. You don't really meet someone like Mary, someone who sends you off in a shimmery landscape like this. I had entered a different place, somewhere out of the known boundaries. How else to explain it? Had I tried to go back, the tear in the fabric would have sealed up, and all would have vanished. After I completed my pilgrimage and returned to St. Paul, I wrote Mary a letter to thank her. 9 months later, I got a letter back. She had lost my letter with my address, then found it half a year later on the dash of her broken pickup. The mechanic had had the truck for 5 months, but had never fixed it. A lot of things like this had happened to Mary Sunshine since I left. She was no longer able to make rent on the apartment and moved out. She was house-sitting in a cabin even smaller than her old place. It had no electricity, no phone, no outhouse, only a wood stove for cooking and heat. I was prepared to hear she had put a halt to her Dorothy Day routine, feeding the hungry, welcoming the stranger, and was just trying to survive. She wrote, "I've been chopping wood and have not been cooking for people. The cabin is half mile off the main road no one visits. I have been really busy hitchhiking almost every day into Taos to get the food bank going. Fry, the computer lists come in from the Santa Fe Food Bank, of which Sunshine Foundation is a member. Taos County Food Bank is the official name with the IRS for my agency for the food bank. Sat or sun, I walk, if no one picks me up, about 8 miles up the hill and back, 4 each way, to confer with the gent who helps distribute. Mun, I hitchhike into town and fax the order. Wed, I line up someone with a truck to pick up. Thurs, delivery. Thurs, I hike in to accept delivery. Sometimes it comes on Fry, then I help load truck and we drive 29 miles to deliver it. Next week, do it all again." It was enough to care for total strangers at her own place, but this? She had mentioned something about a food bank and a Sunshine Foundation, but it just seemed to me like wishful thinking. Of course she's starting a food bank. What else would she be doing? I stare at her words, blue ink crammed onto every inch of perhaps the only clean white sheet of paper she owned, and as if it's a living thing, I ask the letter, "What is going on here? What insane love brings all of this to bear? Did all the mercy in northern New Mexico get concentrated into one tall woman with an axe and little else? Or could it be that she is merely one of those people who can't sit still? Maybe she's a dronish, task-oriented person who needs to fill her days, that's all. How is she this way and why? The gift of a car wreck and a damaged back? Those 30 minutes when she held her palms in the air? Some terrible light from the pure emptiness of the universe that took her soul and placed it right inside the souls of broken human beings everywhere? Just what has gotten into this woman? Remember Thomas? He lived with me at the time you visited and gave you the sleeping bag. We all called him Bird or Birdman because he has the parrot. I have been dating him since April. Went to see him in Santa Fe, where he moved in May to see a specialist about his seizures caused by a motorcycle crash 20 years ago. I went to see him Thanksgiving. He was very shy, wondering if I still cared. My messages were not given to him by the manager of his handicapped housing. I called 12 times. He received 2 messages. My letters came back. At Christmas, we passed each other by a half hour. He went to Taos, I went to Santa Fe. We don't have phones or cars. Ride given by friends. I ended up camping in the Gila wilderness with some friends of friends. He was told I died along the road in Arizona and called the mental health hotline 3 times at payphones in front of grocery store. Manager called police as he was drunk. He's in jail with 3 assaults against officers, so Thomas needs our prayers. The poverty that can so easily lead to charity, who more than anyone else tends to the poor? Other poor people. The prisoner? Other prisoners. Had veered into one of its tragic byways. I hear this story and I see people wandering in the dark, an absolute dark in a burnt-out wasteland, hearing all around them, on the outskirts, the buzzing and clicking and ringing of all the things everyone else has and they do not. We don't have phones or cars. Prophetic and hopeless. We don't have to miss each other by a half hour. We don't, and he's in a parking lot, drunk and freaked out, convinced she's dead. We, and he's in jail. Mary seems to embrace the poverty she's been given. She doesn't get bitter about it. She lives gracefully through it, and life gets harder anyway. She throws her energy into a makeshift foundation that has to recreate its donor base every other day in the form of whoever picks her up hitchhiking. She feeds all the poor people that she can scrounge up. She simply tries to love a man and write him and be with him, and in the end, she is ignored and passed by and presumed dead. Maybe, in spite of all her unflagging resolve, drinking from the Sangre de Cristo doesn't feel redemptive for Mary. Maybe, sometimes, it only seems like more spilled blood. She gets no prizes, only more chaos. Those that have little, even that, will be taken away from them. Sorrowful Mysteries. In the winter, the war was always there, and we did not go to it because we were Jesuits thinking and praying and reading, and sometimes it was Hemingway we read. In the evening, snow fell over Chicago, and it clumped between the slats of the benches outside the classrooms, where every old idea was overturned, only to find there was nothing new beneath. It was a cold winter, and the wind came in off the lake. That winter, a few of us got together on the third anniversary of the invasion of Iraq, just before Lent began, and prayed a rosary on the street near the lake. The idea was that we would all wear our clerics, our black outfits, and hold signs. It would be a mighty thing for drivers to see all these religious people in black praying and demonstrating against the Iraq war. It's an image we felt people hadn't seen so much. But it was so cold and so windy out that most of us had on jackets that covered up our black shirts and small white collars. There was no impressive black line, just a bunch of people in winter coats, beige and green, red and gray. We stood out there anyway. We prayed. We held signs and prayed the sorrowful mysteries, even though it was Monday, the day you pray the joyful mysteries. A few nuns and a few undergrads joined us. There were about 20 of us, Jesuit scholastics, a few of the priests, and these others, lifting from Friday the sorrowful mysteries, the Passion, and announcing them on Monday. Hail Mary, blessed be your womb, the hour of our death. What did it accomplish? What did it matter? A few of us kept doing it on Fridays. It felt strange. We recited the sorrowful mysteries on the appropriate days, Fridays and Lent, strangely. On one of the Fridays, it rained. Whoever was in charge of the signs didn't bring them. He thought they would get ruined. Because there were no signs, I didn't want to pray the rosary that day. The people of Chicago driving by Loyola would have no clear idea why we were out there praying. We couldn't be doing this to them, out there giving confusing signals to sleepy morning drivers. We prayed anyway. O good Jesus, save us from the fires of hell. Lead all souls to heaven, especially those in most need of thy mercy. What was this? Why were we there? How did we mess up? Who left behind the signs to tell the world what we were doing? Our signs for peace when it wasn't raining said to the people of Chicago, peace is our duty, our grave duty. And war is always a defeat for humanity. Two quotes from our recently departed Pope. Another sign said, Lord, have mercy on us. We made these simple signs, and we held them, and we recited the ancient prayers. But really, who were we to hold signs while saying prayers? Isn't it over the solemn clutching of cardboard posters? Aren't we in this era through with it? Haven't we entered a time when this is so primitive and lonely and nonsensical, a sparse row of earnest spiritualists holding signs and praying to end war? Why drag ourselves back a few decades to this kind of thing, holding a sign on a street with traffic going by? It's presumptuous to think that the people out there need to hear our message. It is too righteous by half. It borders on haughty. And there we were in our blacks, feeling it turns ghostly, fraudulent, simplistic, not doing near enough, too little too late, and not entirely convinced that this was hopeless. We wanted at least to do something. A few months before we prayed the rosary on the street, Dan Berrigan came to our school. He was invited to deliver a talk about of all...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?